he encountered on the road a person, and this person beheld the Buddha, saw the Buddha walking, and was struck by the radiance of peace, contentment, perhaps love, compassion, that seemed to shine forth from the Buddha. And he had never seen someone like this before. So he asked the Buddha, "Are you a god, since you're so radiant?" And the Buddha said, "No." And then the person said, "Are you some kind of spirit or ghost?" And the Buddha said, "No." "Are you some kind of angel?" "No." "Are you a human being then?" And the Buddha said, "No." So this person then asked, "Well, who are you? What are you then?" And the Buddha's reply was, "I am awake." The Buddha declined to identify himself as a human being or by any other attribute, as "this is who I am, what I am." But he was willing to define himself as being awake, the wakefulness, the sense of presence that there with clear mindfulness, a wakefulness to life. And the beauty of awakefulness or wakefulness is that it's kind of transparent or luminous, and it contains all things of the world, but in a sense it's not of the world. And the Buddha was now at rest or resting in his wakeful nature. So you might reflect a few moments on what is it that you identify with? Where is it that you get caught up in your life? You identify yourself as a woman or a man or as a particular profession or for having a particular kind of body, or particular psychological circumstances, or some particular history. Some particular image that needs to be defended or protected. To rest in our wakeful nature is to rest in a place that needs no defense, that needs no fear. Could you imagine shifting your center of gravity so that you rest, the center of your life becomes the wakefulness, the clear, luminous sense of presence right now that's timeless? Because it's the very presence that you are now. It's not you that feels the breath as you breathe. It's the wakeful nature, it's wakefulness itself. It's not you that hears my voice, but it's wakefulness, a wakefulness. And as I ring this bell, you need do nothing. But as I ring the bell to end the sitting, it is your wakeful nature that hears the bell. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to our class. And so this is the second day of refuge class. And we'll meet twice more, and then October 3rd in the evening we'll have our ceremony. And I think maybe next week I'll hopefully know a little better about where we're going to meet. We're still looking for a place where we can have our refuge ceremony and our potluck dinner on October 3rd. And so if anybody has an idea, but probably what we'll do is do it at St. Mark's if no one comes forth with some wonderful backyard. That seems perfect. Let's start by everyone introducing themselves again, like last time. Go around.
Allison.
Anne.
Rainbow.
Andrea.
Holly.
Jenny.
Katie. Dave.
Marcia.
Jonathan.
Rob.
Diane.
Lori.
Melissa.
Julie.
Jennifer.
Sandy.
Molly.
Linda.
Richard.
Marina.
Dave.
Elizabeth, Sharon, Nadja, Barbara,
Dick,
Margaret, Lee. So the triple refuge is sometimes called the triple treasure. Or the triple gem, the Ti Ratna in Pali. And the idea being, I think, that the triple treasure is something that's something really, really precious. And when I was thinking about today and coming and speaking about the refuges, I thought some about my own inspiration when I think in relationship to them. And I get quite inspired. And one of the things that results from the inspiration I have about the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha is a sense of a confidence and devotion in relationship both towards those particular objects, but also to what they represent within me, the potential and the possibility within me that I've experienced or I experience. And it's something which is quite uplifting and gives me a lot of motivation for me in my practice. And different people will come to the Triple Refuge from different perspectives. Some people will be more from a sense of understanding, and some people will be more from a sense of experience. I mean, experience something that resonates really deeply with these so-called objects. And some people will come more out of a sense of a devotion, a tremendous love, a feeling of great inspiration in relationship to them. So each of you might have come in a a very different relationship to the refuges. The first refuge is the Buddha. And the Buddha is the first refuge because, in a sense, it all started with him. The Buddha was very careful to say that the experience of awakening, the teachings of awakening, the Dharma, he didn't invent them. They existed before him and existed after him. But he was the person who discovered it in our particular historical times. So he becomes quite significant for us. And I sometimes feel a tremendous amount of gratitude towards this fellow, the Buddha, because it's had such a big impact on me, his teachings, and the way that I received his teachings from the people who I've practiced with, that I can't imagine what my life would be like anymore if I hadn't encountered those teachings and those practices. If I tried to imagine what I'd be like without having contact with them, I remember what I was like when I was 20 and 21, and some of the tendencies and some of the personality traits and ego trips that I was on, and some of the ways in which I held tension in my body. And I kind of imagine what it would have been like if that had continued for the next 25 years, without any kind of interruption or any kind of liberation or any kind of possibility of dropping all the ways in which I held stress and tension and suffering in my body and my heart and my mind. And when I think about it that way, it seems like a frightening prospect. I think I would have been a very different person, and I wouldn't have been as happy as I am now. So I feel tremendous gratitude for the Buddha, for someone who got started this particular tradition that I've been involved in quite a bit. And it's said, when people take refuge in the Buddha, that there are there's many ways of seeing it, but two general senses of what the Buddha is. One of them is as the historical person. And some people have a very close kind of feeling for this historical person and find a lot of inspiration from him. And some people it doesn't relate to, this particular person. And that's, fine. But sometimes it's a historical person. And the other thing is the historical person is not special in any way, only special because he became awakened. He discovered this wonderful thing called enlightenment or awakefulness or awakening, which transformed him. And as a result, transformed many of the people who came after him, who were influenced by his teachings and practices. And so it isn't the Buddha himself per se, but rather it's his awakened nature, his enlightened nature, his liberated nature, which is what's special. And so when we take refuge in the Buddha, it's not taking refuge in this person so much, but one understanding is we're taking refuge in this potential that he has fulfilled. He's the exemplar of what's possible. And it's like the 4-minute mile, until someone is able to run the 4-minute mile or break the 4-minute mile, and no one thought it could be done. But once the first person ran the 4-minute mile, then a lot of people did afterwards. It's like the 60-second home run, right? Now it's, that seems to happen every day. So maybe it's a little bit the same way with, the Buddha discovered some potential, some possibility. And because he discovered it, it's been easier for the rest of us to follow suit, to recognize it in ourselves. So in taking refuge in the potential for awakening or the awakened nature, we're also, in a sense, taking refuge in that potential inside of us, something we each know for ourselves. And that, I think, is really what's the most profound kind of taking refuge, is some kind of sense, whether it's an understanding or whether it's a trust or whether it's some experiential sense, that there's something deep inside of yourself, some deep experience of peace, of contentment, of awakefulness, of joy, of compassion, that is very precious for you, and that somehow seems to resonate with the idea of a Buddha, someone who's fully awakened. My own appreciation of the Buddha only deepens with the deeper that my own spiritual experiences, the deepest experiences I've had in meditation, the experience of being very awake or very present, the experience of being I'm a little bit uncomfortable using this word, but it's really the best word that I have for it, the experience of tremendous purity that comes from deep spiritual liberation or freedom, purification of all the different ways in which we add stress to our lives and suffering to our lives, purification from greed and purification from hate and confusion, delusion. And this sense of to have some taste, even a partial taste, of the potential of the mind or the heart to have some tremendous purity or purification gave me a sense of what a Buddha could be. Because the Buddha for me represents someone, whether it's true or not, the Buddha represents someone who's done it completely. Who that level of purification, of purity of mind and heart, he cultivated and developed it to the full potential that a human being can. So I see in myself the degree that I've cultivated something like that, and I can see there's still a lot more room for a lot more development, a lot more kind of expanding it or including, much more integrating it, much more bigger part of my life. And so I see the Buddha, for me, the Buddha, whether it's true or not, he represents that potential that I have if I allow this to really grow and really fill my whole being, which it could, if you know, in theory at least. And I find that tremendously inspiring to have that as an example, or have that in a sense like a goal to develop that level of awakening or freedom that is complete and not just partial in the way that I've experienced it so far. And when I study myself, I notice that not only do I notice that potential, but I also notice the things that get in the way for that. So in a sense, perhaps the veils or the hindrances to my wakefulness or my liberation kind of shining forth clearly and being complete in all areas of my life. It's one thing for me to sit in meditation and experience some level of freedom. It's another for me to to do it in all kinds of other circumstances in my life. We had a very interesting discussion last week at the Spirit Rock Teachers meeting. There were 14 of Spirit Rock teachers there, most of the teachers. And we had 2 days of meetings. And the first day, our agenda was to try to be more honest and open to each other, to our colleagues, you know, like people at work, right? These are the people I work with. So it seems like a good thing to do. And one of the surprises was, to all of us, I think, who were there and people have been practicing for many years, was one of the things that was somewhat an obstacle or somewhat an issue for them, for everyone there pretty much, was fear. They were concerned, for example, when the teachers teach together, there was a certain level of apprehension about, well, if I give a Dharma talk, what do my colleagues think of my Dharma talk? They're not going to like it. You know, or Jack Kornfield, he's kind of like, Jack Kornfield trained a lot of the people at Spirit Rock, a lot of the teachers, so he's kind of like the elder. And so like when Jack's listening to my Dharma talk, I'm a little bit afraid, or this and that. And so the issue of fear was still present for many of these people, and was certainly present for me. I still have fear at times in certain circumstances. And I see fear as being a hindrance that in some ways hinders my ability to for this potential I have to really flower completely. And rather than getting hung up on my fear and being, you know, taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the awakened nature, is to see that actually I'm much more than my fear. There's something about life or being alive that I can trust that's bigger, in a sense, a larger container than the particular fear that I might have in any particular time, with particular greed or desire or ambition or confusion or whatever it might be in any particular moment. There's something about who I am or who we all are that's actually much bigger than any particular obstacle we might have. And take refuge in the Buddha is, in a sense, a kind of resting ourselves or kind of stepping back and not getting so caught up anxiously by identifying with our particular problems and concerns and realizing there's much more going on here. There's a wider sense of who we are than our particular identifications. And then to find some, seeing that, then feeling more trustful about not being in struggle with oneself. So for me, one of the things taking refuge in means is I'm less likely to struggle with myself. And when I take refuge, when I'm inspired and I take refuge, it's for me, it's a time to give up my struggle for a deeper sense of who I am, in favor of a deeper, more enlightened sense of who I am, that potential and that possibility. Does that make sense? So that's a little bit kind of from me. what I thought that what you guys can do now is why don't you form little pairs? Why don't you find a partner? And why don't you just do that? Find a partner in silence and sit next to your partner. And there can be a group of three if there's even an odd number here. Okay. So what I'm interested in having you discuss, sharing, if you're willing, a little bit about what you see as... What does the Buddha represent for you, personally, in the way I was talking about what you feel is your kind of maybe potential or possibility, or maybe in relationship to something you've experienced, something you know. You've had some kind of experience of peace or contentment or joy or well-being or feeling of things, you know, something that seems to resonate with or echo with this ideal of a Buddha or someone who's fully awakened, and that this is something which is a kind of a place of refuge or a place of inspiration for you. So why don't you talk, something about that that's very personal for yourself. And then once you've kind of shared that a little bit, then talk a little bit about what gets in the way of that. You don't have to, necessarily dredge up the worst demons you have. But talk a little bit, and it could also be very generally, but a little bit about things that the hindrances and obstacles to that. And you don't have to... have solutions, and your partner doesn't have to offer you any. But you're just kind of saying, this is what my obstacles are, and how that is for you. Okay. So go ahead. So it was lovely to sit and watch you guys talk.
Or change.
And. What was that? How was that like for some of you to share that?
Joy, positive.
Yeah, positive.
Yeah.
Surprising.
How so?
I had no idea what I was going to say before I started talking, and then I started thinking about the question, and it all just kind of spilled out.
And you were surprised by what you said?
Yeah. I was surprised that I was able to formulate it in it. Intelligible way. Mm. I think it was intelligible.
Mine just sprang me with a sense of immediacy, and I'd like to say what it was equanimity. I've been hearing about that in other contexts for a long time before this practice, and then in this practice as well, and then there was a talk that you gave one night on it, and it just sort of penetrated my whole being. You know, that feeling that you just hear a talk and then it was written for you, and there I was saying yes to it. And I didn't know quite what I called that, you know, lesson for me. You say that's the Buddha, that's my Buddha, I guess. And to be able to have practical experience with sort of slowing down enough to really feel that experientially, not just here, but like, wow, this thing happened to me, and here I was able to do this thing. And it's very, very gratifying. Mm-hmm. And what gets in the way is that it's still...
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rainbow. When you started talking, Allison asked me to explain what it is that I do when I take refuge, more practically. And you know, kind of, I guess she meant more on the inner side, the interior aspect of going for refuge. And I guess in reflecting on it, it means different things for me. I mean, at times, going for refuge is an opportunity for me to express my gratitude. And I think that the spiritual life, at some point or other, will entail some feelings of gratitude. And in Buddhism, we're kind of an odd religion, because we don't necessarily have to have an object to our gratitude. We just can be grateful. But still, even just being grateful, it's nice to have a channel, a way to express it. And one of the channels and the objects that you can take is the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And so going for refuge is to express that gratitude that I feel. Another thing is it's kind of a surrender to take refuge for me, or kind of a letting go. Some of you talked about the obstacles that you might have towards this deep sense of presence with yourself. What going for refuge is in part is kind of surrendering or yielding myself into this which is deeper than I know that it's true. So not getting hung up on the obstacles, not being identified with the obstacles, not being discouraged by the obstacles when they're there, but recognizing or surrendering to something which is deeper or wider or more complete about who I am. So taking refuge is also kind of surrendering myself to this thing. But it's very important to realize that this kind of surrender or yielding or letting go into it doesn't belong to the world of our self-centeredness, our personal desires, what we want for myself, you know. When the Buddha said that I'm awakened, he was specifically not identifying himself with his personality, where a lot of us identify ourselves with some aspects of our personality or with our desires, our motivations and wishes. And for me, there's a sense of taking refuge is to surrender myself to give up, in a sense, my small sense of self. I might want to say a larger sense of self, or no sense of self, or something which is beyond the personal kind of identifications I might have with the small aspects of myself, the image of myself, my own fears and all these things. So taking refuge is kind of like, it's a kind of relief to take refuge in a sense. Whew, let me take refuge. Let me just, you know, surrender. Let me go for protection in this wider sense of the truth, which I know is there. Something like that. So what do you want to talk about? Do you have any questions or comments about this? You've talked with each other, but otherwise I've monopolized the floor, mostly. Do you want to ask any questions or? Jonathan?
I feel like there are a couple of attributes which particularly sabotage my ability to be more like what I consider Buddha. And I find insight meditation very helpful in becoming aware of that. Sometimes I sort of desire something more aggressive, more direct approach, something that will help me deal with being, for example, impatient. And I wonder if there are other means to doing that.
There are lots of means. The world is full of means. You can certainly find other means, and mindfulness is a means, in a sense, if you do it thoroughly. But mindfulness also offers itself not as a means, but as in and of itself a radical reorientation to the problem. For some people that makes a lot of sense, that rather than struggling with a problem, by being clearly aware this is a problem for me and there's suffering in it. But that clear awareness itself is a moment of not identifying with it, of resting in something larger. It's kind of like stepping outside the game. So you don't need the means anymore. It's okay for it to be there. That's a step that's available to some people, and that's one way that mindfulness can work. Traditionally in Buddhism, And patience is seen as an aversion, a form of aversion. And one of the antidotes that's offered for any kind of aversion, including impatience, is to do loving kindness practice. And so you might reflect a little bit on yourself. In the experience of impatience that you have, what do you think the connection is between that and loving kindness? And kindness. Is there a connection for you that you can find? And if you can find the connection between the two of them, then maybe there's a way in which you understand the impatience from a different angle. And you see that there's a more valuable opportunity in any given moment than to have aversion to what's happening. Does that make sense? So I offer you loving kindness as a more powerful means. So you can cultivate loving kindness, you can bring loving kindness to bear in the present moment. You can understand, for example, that perhaps for you, I don't know, but perhaps for you that when the impatience is there, loving kindness is not there. And what would you rather be? And rather than doing the analysis or the mindfulness of the impatience, you might actually start cultivating a loving kindness practice so that it's right there at hand when you need it. And that'll actually help you come into the full. Impatience is an unwillingness to be present for what's happening. And maybe the loving kindness practice will help you to do that, to be having a willingness to be present. So that's what occurs to me to say.
But then that's true with restlessness, right? You know, if you're impatient, you become agitated and you become restless.
Yeah, it can go both directions. A person can get restless first and then get impatient. Or some people might get impatient about something and then get restless. So one of the fascinating things with mindfulness is you start seeing the causal connection there, how one thing leads to another. So it can be either direction.
So loving kindness would help in that sense when you feel restless.
Yes, it's possible to have restlessness without impatience or without aversion. And then if a person's interested in antidotes, the antidote to restlessness is concentration practice, to cultivate real stillness of attention in one particular object, to counter the scatteredness with that settledness.
Talking about being the self and the non-self, that concept is pretty hard, I mean, to live when you live in a world.
Yeah.
I learned that as time goes on, I kind of not really put judgment on people. I'm getting better with that.
Did you do what?
Not judge people.
Judging people, yeah.
Which, you know, I feel that, you know, that's my improvement. But then when I thought I was being judged, even I thought, oh, that's non-self, not me, you know, those concepts. But it's still hard to take though. You know, even I don't judge people now. I try not to, but then when I'm being judged,
yeah,
then the self, you know, identification with self comes up.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So this is some of the this is another example of the kind of what I called obstacles that somehow get in the way, and part of the function of taking refuge is to orient ourselves to an understanding or a felt sense that we are greater or bigger than our judgments. And that can be very liberating to realize that. There's a way in which many of us get locked on our particular obstacles and we make them blow it out of proportion. And taking refuge is hopefully to change the perspective we have on our particular problems. So we realize that there's something much greater in any given moment than our particular obstacle, our particular, you know, if it's judging or impatience or whatever. And part of taking refuge then for some people would be to surrender to that which is larger. This larger sense of self. Or, yes?
Taking refuge has triggered in me fear and a lot of. And it's almost at two levels. There's one level I understand intellectually, but my emotional reaction when I think of accepting that and coming out of a very individualistic culture where you have to take responsibility for yourself and her thing, that triggers a lot of fear of, and it may be fear of myself is what's being triggered,
uh-huh.
but fear of relaxing and accepting and trusting, there might be this fear of trusting.
That seems quite appropriate. To have fear like that. I think anybody, at some point, anyone who does a spiritual practice like this is going to encounter fear. Because you realize at some point that what you've been holding on to is not serving you. But you have, there's very little sense of how you're going to take care of yourself without this usual reference. It's just somewhat
yes.
And so it's good that you feel fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's nice to feel a safe place to identify.
Yes, yes. And but you don't have, you can also respect the fear and not be in a hurry. But taking refuge is also, for some people, taking refuge is both a challenge in the kind of way you talked about, but also at the same time can offer a sense of support, because we have the example. One of the things we have the example of the Buddha. And also the Sangha, the community of fellow practitioners who've been there before. And they've managed, they've coped with the same issues.
Right.
And they're functioning just fine in their lives, and they're quite happy and content.
Well, that's the intellectual level. I know
yes.
that.
Yeah.
I hear it. I understand it. And that's what gives me hope.
Right.
Hearing and knowing that. But actually going through the process triggers the emotional response to it.
Right.
And just going through that.
But having intellectual... understanding can actually make it a little bit easier to be willing to go through the emotional fear.
Well, that's fine.
Yes.
I hate that.
Good. Yes.
Along that kind of thinking, what I'm conceptualizing is, in some countries you can have dual citizenship.
Yes.
And it's quite sanctioned. And in the other countries, you're either a citizen of that country or you're not.
Right.
I think my home religion is a single citizenship religion.
Oh, yeah.
So that's very, and even though I'm not actively practicing that, it's very much a part of who I am.
Yeah.
So now I come upon Buddhism, which says, hey, you don't have to give up anything. Mm. Take this on, and whatever else you want to do is fine.
Right.
And I really like that philosophy, and that's what's drawing me into it.
Right.
That's why I'm adopting it. But with this taking refuge, I must say that resonated for me. There's a little intrepidation that there's some part of me that's saying, you're not supposed to do this. We don't sanction it. So, as much as I'm wanting to go forward with it, I just feel like saying it out loud.
Great.
Is,
thank you.
But there is that message.
Thank you, yes. And a lot can be said about it. Maybe the simple thing I can say is that it's a Western definition to call Buddhism a religion. So maybe Buddhism is not a religion at all. Therefore, it's not an issue of being a dual citizenship. Your religion can be what it was or it is, and then you do this whole Buddhism. Like a lot, you know, if a person's Jewish or Catholic or Buddhist, you know, they all go to their psychoanalysts, right? It's not a problem, you know. You know, or you go to your doctor, you know, like what? Or whatever.
There's a lot of psychoanalysts
to Buddhists. Yeah, also, yes. Yeah, so maybe that's helpful, too. But maybe, this wasn't the best example, but, you know, like, I'm a member of Kaiser, right? And, you know, being whatever, a Catholic, and being a member of Kaiser is not a problem for, you know, because Kaiser is not a religion in the way that Catholicism is. It is. So what I guess it's getting too complicated now. What I'm suggesting is that people are concerned about this issue of dual and single citizenship with religion, are playing a particular game of definitions of what is religion, and maybe Buddhism doesn't have to be involved in that kind of game. So your involvement with Buddhism doesn't have to necessarily pertain to the same thing that you're doing with another religion. So, for example, Buddhism generally is not considered to be theistic. In the West, definition of religion is something that believes in God. So you don't have to be you don't have to feel there's a conflict. Does that make sense at all?
Mm-hmm. That's helpful.
Magda.
Can I answer that? there is also, that's very helpful to say. There is also
the tradition of the leaders and the traditions all have a tendency to say, choose one. You know, like they'll sort of berry pick your paths and
right.
pick a little from each, but choose one. I mean, the Dalai Lama, for instance, was pretty clear about deciding which one is the main one.
Yeah.
Although I personally like to
devil.
You know, from the different.
But that's kind of a different issue then. The issue, the one issue is affiliation. You know, where you put your belief and your creed and all that. And the other is if you're engaged in a spiritual practice, as opposed to a spiritual faith or belief, then practically, it's at some point it's quite going to be useful to kind of stick with one for a while. So you can get some depth. Because what happens with many people is they start with one particular tradition, and it's sooner or later all spiritual practices are challenge us, and we get afraid, or we get uncomfortable, or we get impatient, or we get judgmental, or you know something happens. You know, in relationship to the spiritual practice, something gets difficult, and we get challenged, and some people then will just say, well, forget about this. All we do is sit around sitting quiet and still all the time. You know, I think Sufi dancing must be better. And so then they do Sufi dancing until the same, you know, we just bring ourselves with us wherever we go, right? So we do. So for a while, Sufi dancing is really great and wonderful. Everybody should be doing this. And after we do it for a few years, it's suddenly this, you realize what it requires of you. And you're like, oh, forget Sufi dancing. I think what I want to do is, you know, something else. And so that's part one of the dangers of not sticking to things, is we don't go through the difficulty. And so there's value to sticking to something. But it's not universal. It's not like absolute, you know, God mandated, you know, like you have to decide one or the other. It's more of a strategy. It's strategically quite useful to kind of stay for a while in one place. It would be quite, yes. No, what should I say?
Everything that goes on here is just so relevant to me that I'm kind of jumping around, like impatience is my name. But I wanted to share this experience that I had this past week or two of Rich and I were talking about how life is so filled with so much, and work and family and projects and things, and I would see people and have the feeling that what's new, Marina, was this, you know, what I wanted to share. And I started doing this at a social occasion, and halfway through it, I heard myself and sort of realized it was sort of on the, like, my child is honor student. You know what I mean?
You're identifying, this is one more of the litany of things that you can...
Yeah, you know, and
I ate at the best Chinese restaurant yesterday, you know. You know.
It was very genuinely the most sort of when people say what have you been doing?
Yeah.
I mean, you might have 10 things, but you usually pick one, you know. And that would be the one, except that I realized how it was just taking place in this context. Being like another, oh, that's neat, and I went to Tahiti for a vacation. You know, it just felt wrong to put it there. And I awkwardly sort of stopped in this sentence and floundered around, which I don't usually do. And I guess I was being kind of hard on myself, you know. And sort of, it was a genuine impulse, and yet I thought it feels better not to talk about this in that way.
So what would be a more profound relationship to refuge than the way you were kind of casually talking about it?
Well, it's something that I'm aware of all day long, every day, you know, and that it's been kind of like the way you use the word orientation.
Uh-huh.
It's been really like 15 years or so that I could feel, you know, this shift, and now I'm more focused. It's more central, but it's part of an ongoing thing. Yeah. And it's it's very personal.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. As I've said last time, one of the definitions of someone who's a Buddhist is someone who's taken the refuge, triple refuge. But you can take triple refuge without assuming you're a Buddhist. So make sense of that as you wish. But I think for me, more important than becoming a Buddhist, much more important than becoming Buddhist, I don't really want people to become Buddhists per se. Becoming a Buddhist and you say, now I'm a Buddhist. More profound, I think, is when other people start recognizing those qualities inside of you. They say, oh, that person's a Buddhist. Not because you're dogmatically kind of flying the Buddhist flag, but because there's some equanimity, some kindness, some loving kindness, some joy, some presence, some awareness, some of the different generosity, some of the qualities that are really honored in the Buddhist tradition. Somehow have taken root in that person, and the person is beginning to somehow express them or motivated to try to express them, and other people see that. That, I think, is actually much more profound and interesting than becoming, I'm a Buddhist. Make sense?
Gil, I was just wondering if you could define equanimity. I mean, I know maybe somewhat what it might mean in the dictionary, but...
evenness in awareness itself. It might mean that we have thoughts and ideas about it, but awareness itself doesn't get hooked onto it. So, for example, I had a tremendous, powerful equanimity once on a retreat, and then someone did something rude to me, and it wasn't me doing it even. There was almost just anger arose, but the equanimity was unruffled. It was like the anger just kind of arose and passed through me, and there were no hooks, no identification, no involvement with it. I didn't push it away or hold on to it. So it's allowing ourselves to be as we are without needing to push it away or holding on to anything. That's one definition. Some people will call that an evenness of mind or balance of mind. Yes?
I just wanted to share a definition of Buddhism that Lama Suryadas gave last night at his talk at Printers, Inc., which I found particularly helpful, especially being Jewish and having some of these similar conflicts about, am I taking on something that I shouldn't be, and all that stuff. He said, like you said, that Buddhism is not a religion. That's just something that Westerners have labeled it well after the Buddha's time.
Right.
And he defined it as an ethical, psychological, and philosophical path of awakening.
And my response to that is that the heartfelt quality of it seems to have been left out of the definition.
Mm-hmm.
It seems kind of dry.
Mm-hmm.
There is an emotional aspect to any spiritual path, including Buddhism. Sometimes people see Buddhism as kind of maybe a little bit on the drier side of compared to Sufi dancing or some other religions. But I like Sufi dancings, by the way. It's not like I don't have a thing against it. I think it's great. But it's a little bit drier. But there is an emotional aspect, and that's why earlier I talked about how there's I feel a devotion and confidence and kind of love towards a triple refuge, and that's an emotional thing, or feelings of gratitude. So if there isn't that warmth, some kind of warmth, I would rather not think of it as Buddhism. Mm-hmm. There seems to be some warmth. Yes.
I just wanted to share. I feel that warmth and devotion towards Thich Nhat Hanh, and I read one time where he said he encouraged us not to give up our roots. That would just create more separation. But bring that quality of mindfulness into whatever our tradition is. And
that's
felt very warm. Good. I wanted to ask you, a couple times I've used the idea of generosity when I was feeling impatient.
Oh.
Just giving up, or just expanding space.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Is that considered an antidote, traditionally?
I haven't read any traditional books that talk about that, but it makes a lot of sense to me. So try that too, Jonathan. I'm telling Jonathan to try that also. So I wanted us to do just a very teeny bit of chanting, but I think we're over our time. So maybe, because part of the ritual, the refuge ceremonies, we'll do some Pali chanting. So I wanted to get you a little bit familiar with it before we did it. But I guess we'll save it for next week. One of the things I want to say is that we did tape it this time, in case anyone, we'll tape it from now on, in case someone misses a class and wants to listen to it on tape. We might not, actually tell you where we're going to meet until. until the last class, the last Thursday in 2 weeks from today. So if for some reason you don't come to that Thursday class, you should probably call me or call someone who is here, because you need to get, you'll get some very specific instructions, not only about where it's going to be, but also what you have to, there's some things you have to do, something you have to bring for the ceremony and things like that. So it's very simple stuff, but it's there's something you need to know. So so if you missed that last class, make sure you find out some way, get that information. That make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll save the chanting for next time, and I thank you all very much.